Hammond, welcome. You'd like to introduce your team with you today?
Madam Chair, I have to my right Chris Boswell, Vice President for Government Community Relations. Behind me, to my left, I have Dave Moorbacher, the Director of the Enhanced Oil Recovery Institute. To my right, in the red, is Janet Lowe, the Vice President for Administration. And directly behind me, the tall fellow, is Mike Massey in the President's office.
I think, Mr. President, we're beginning a capital alum type here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I thought I would make some introductory comments. I would begin with comments regarding the budget reduction. I want to start by saying we certainly appreciate the fact that the governor is recommending a 6% rather than an 8% cut for the university. But a 6% reduction certainly won't be achieved without some pain. At 8%, the reduction was $15,664,000. The 6% will be $11.4 million. There are primarily four areas of reduction. But let me go back for a minute and remind the committee there were principles that we followed in making decisions about what areas to reduce. Number one, reductions must be consistent with UW's vision and strategic plan. Number two, to the greatest extent possible, we would attempt to preserve and, if possible, advance academic quality. And number three, preference would be given to reductions first to non-personnel areas and to do that as much as possible before impacting personnel. In terms of the budget reduction, again, our general fund budget is $195,800,000. The 8% original budget reduction exercise was to remove $15.6 million. The governor's recommendation was for $11.4 million in four areas of reduction. The first was to reduce non-personnel support budgets. And I'm using the 6% figures here by $4,575,000. That would consist of reductions in library collections, instructional excellence, student services, and the like. It would also include reductions in intercollegiate athletics, reducing funds for student visits, recruiting contacts, team travel and equipment. It would reduce funding for classroom technology and research computing, and it would reduce funding for operations and maintenance. The second area of reduction would be to reduce scholarships and graduate education funds, graduate stipends. That reduction was for $1.725 million. I want to point out here that the large majority of these funds and all of the reduction of scholarship support would be taken from non-resident scholarship funds, not from resident scholarship support, and that this does not include any Hathaway scholarships, which are administered by the state treasurer. Our total scholarship budget at this point is $16.3 million. The consequences from this move would be to increase student debt, particularly for non-resident students. It may reduce some enrollment from our out-of-state students. There would likely be fewer renewable scholarships and more caps on those scholarships, and it certainly would result in some reduction in graduate education initiatives as a result of the reduction in graduate stipends. The third item that we would reduce are staff, faculty, and administrative positions. $4.8 million in this category. About 74% of the Section 1 budget at the university is salary plus employer-paid benefits. So, quite frankly, some personnel reductions will be unavoidable with a reduction of this magnitude. At present, UW has right at 3,000 benefited employees. We estimate, depending upon which positions are reduced, between 60 and 95 positions would be lost. Primarily, certainly our intention is through attrition and then layoffs if attrition is not sufficient to get us within our budget. The
Kenneth,
yes.
Just on that topic, if you for the university, do you have enough attrition in all areas that you can still keep your focus on what are the core areas of the university? And I guess my concern is that are you more likely to lose your best faculty and your most important competitive areas? And so the attrition policy, if you rely on it for reduction, tends to push you away from your areas of where you ought to have concentration.
Mr. Chairman, the attrition is managed strategically so that if we have, let's say, 100 staff that turn over in a given calendar year, each quarter we will be grouping, pulling together the resources from the vacant staff positions. The vice presidents meet with their priorities, and we establish priorities and critical positions that have to be refilled based on our strategic priorities at the university, and we work our way down that list. So losing or having a vacancy created in important or priority position does not mean that's the position that's held open. If it were a priority, it would be refilled, but at the in the aggregate, those funds, those positions are all reviewed, and the lowest priorities are not refilled to hit whatever target goal we have established for ourselves. Now, we have already begun this process. Earlier this spring, I directed the provost to hold $1 million from the faculty hiring pool. There was about $3.5 million that rolled into the central administration from vacant faculty positions at the university. The deans established their priorities. They meet together to establish the institutional set of priorities, and those positions are authorized from the highest priority as far down the list as there is money to hire. In this case, there were 12 positions that we would have liked to hire for faculty positions, but by recouping that $1 million, we were unable to. Those 12 positions will be placed into the discussion for this next year, along with the vacancies that come available this year. But we will always fill first our priority positions, both on the faculty side and on the staff side. We're doing the same sort of process with staff, but we're doing it on a quarterly basis since staff hiring is routine throughout the year and faculty hiring typically only occurs in the spring. We met at the end of the first quarter with 78 staff vacancies, and from that we pooled those resources. All of the vice presidents at the university met to discuss priority hiring needs that they had, and we held back on 28 positions that we have recouped the dollars from, about $750,000. So right now we have held back about $1.7 million from our hiring, and we'll continue on the staff side to do this through the remainder of the year. And I am not absolutely certain, but I am confident that if we continue to be judicious in how we authorize searches for vacant positions, if we continue to address our priority needs, but not necessarily the needs that fall at the very bottom of our lists, that we will be able to accommodate personnel reductions without layoffs.
When you set the policies, you talked about meeting with the presidents or the of each of the colleges. How do the trustees get involved, or do they get involved at that level in terms of trying to set the priorities or understanding what the constraints and the restrictions are going to be?
Mr. Chairman, I think there are three places the Board of Trustees gets involved. First, their involvement and monitoring of the strategic plan and its implementation, which sets priorities for the university in areas of focus, critical academic focus. That would be one. Number two, they are briefed and rebriefed on the status of vacancies, on the status of authorizations. It's part of the routine. It's a routine part of a fall board meeting. And third, it is the Board of Trustees that has to approve any hires that we would move forward with.
You know, when we met with the governor informally and during his budget message, I think we have as much anxiety about the cuts this year as we do when do we begin to see a regrowth in our revenues. So are we plateauing revenues? How long are we going to plateau out? But what we do know is that experience tells us that your expenses, your labor costs are not going to plateau. So we may be looking at increases to the retirement program. Your health insurance typically goes up 5% to as much as 10%. So that if we're exacting the 6% cut at a time when your labor costs are going up, what we know from the last 10% cut is within 2 years or within a short time, our labor costs exceeded what they did pre 10% cut. So I'm kind of curious I assume then if you are experiencing that, you know that's going to take place. The issue of attrition and reducing faculty numbers is there regardless of the 6% cut for a long time. And I don't know when we know all of a sudden we can start growing FTEs, even though our wages are going up.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, and the system that we have in place accommodates that. It also, for example, in any given year, the mix of full professors against associate professors against assistant professors may vary, and the dollars that we have for faculty hiring may not stretch as far with as many positions as in a year when our hiring is primarily at the assistant professor level. So as those personnel costs increase, it simply means that the personnel dollars that we have freed up from year to year stretch further or don't stretch as far, but we don't exceed what we have to spend.
In terms of your general fund money outside the block grant, what's it doing in terms of your revenues, your tuition, and other areas? Are you seeing increases there, or is it plateauing itself?
Mr. Chairman, I would say that we see that primarily in a couple of areas. We see it certainly a big chunk of the Section 2 revenues are on the research side, about $100 million a year. And those revenues, as they come in, are pre-dedicated, if you will. They are expended as per a proposal that has been funded by some external agency. And so dollar amounts for salaries, for equipment, for whatever costs are associated with that research contract are accounted for. Either the dollars go up or the magnitude of the research project goes down, but they maintain a balance between what they have to work with and what they're able to get done. Probably the biggest single area that we have that's a Section 2 enterprise at the university is our housing and food service. Those numbers are climbing. I'm going to say they have climbed, I would estimate, 3 to 4% a year, keeping pace with the inflationary costs of utilities for our housing and food costs for our food service. Salaries stay constant with our Section 2 employees, consistent with the policies that we have for our Section 1. So we don't treat Section 2 employees differently than Section 1 employees. When we do have funds available for salary increases for Section 1 employees, we indicate to all of the Section 2 enterprises that they too can distribute an equal percentage to their Section 2 employees if they have those funds available. And if they don't have those funds available, then salaries aren't adjusted upwards on Section 2 employees. No, it's not. Tuition is a Section 1 revenue source, non-appropriated Section 1 revenue source, and it has climbed over the last 10 years. I'm going to say largely the result of increasing the number of non-resident students, particularly those from the Front Range of Colorado who choose Wyoming as their school to attend. As those numbers have climbed, we've seen a shift in the proportion of resident to non-resident undergraduate students, and with that comes an increased revenue because the non-resident students are paying, if they pay full sticker price, they pay 3.4 times the tuition rate of our resident students. They frequently don't pay full sticker price, but they do pay substantially more.
President Buchan, going back to your staff vacancies, do you find that 75 staff vacancies is a norm for you in a quarter?
Madam Chair, I think it was larger than usual, primarily because I called for a freeze on hiring without vice presidential exception last spring at about the time the state instituted the same policies. So we had a larger accumulation in this first quarter than I expect to see in subsequent quarters. If I were going to speculate now, we will take a look at the pool. We will review vacant positions, determine which ones are essential to fill, hold open the remainder. But I expect we will be reviewing something close to half of the volume that we had during the first quarter. So I'd say 35 to 40.
But if you're not thinking about what you said when you say that out-of-state students don't pay the full cost of education, but they pay a higher percentage, and I assume that the reason why it still makes sense is because you have a certain fixed cost, and if you've got fixed costs, you're better off to have more students, even if they're not paying the full price. Is that?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would say it depends some on your perspective. If you look at the total cost of education and you look at the percentage of the cost that the students pay through their tuition, it is in the teens. I would say for our resident students, they are probably paying somewhere on the order of 13 or 14 cents on the dollar for the cost of their education. For the non-resident students, it may be up 22, 24, 25% of the cost of their education, but there is still a substantial amount of the total cost which is absorbed through Section 1 and other revenue sources that we have. So all students represent a net drain, if you will, because they don't pay the full cost of their education, but they do pay more.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. You said that the out-of-state students often don't pay the full sticker price. What things would what would cause that?
Yeah.
What's the off the sticker price?
Several things, but I can lump them primarily into the category of non-resident scholarships that we might award to those students to attract them. At this point, we are attracting some of the best and brightest students from Colorado to attend UW. In fact, the reduction in scholarship and graduate education funds that I mentioned earlier, to the tune of $1.725 million, about $1.6 million of that are non-resident scholarship funds that we have previously been distributing as a recruiting tool to attract the best Colorado students to attend the University of Wyoming. We won't have those funds in the future. Will that impact our enrollment? Perhaps. But the population growth along the Colorado Front Range is sufficient that we think that the impact on that will be something that our continued low costs, despite the reduction in scholarships, that we'll still have good turnout from non-resident students.
How are those scholarships funded? Is that just part of the block grant, and those are state dollars that are funding those scholarships?
Madam Chairman, no. Those are private scholarships that are awarded to the university, managed through the foundation. Many of them are longstanding and endowed, and they come with a wide variety of stipulations, whether or not they are to be awarded to residents, to non-residents. Some cases, that's not specified. In some cases, the scholarships are as specific as saying it must go to a freshman resident student from Carbon County majoring in the College of Business. As often as not, there are scholarships that carry stipulations like that.
So then, Madam Chairman, that actually is revenue in to the university. So it's as if those kids were paying the full boat, it's just coming from a different source instead of their pocket.
Yes.
But it's still money in.
It's still money in, and it's still money that would be lost.
Madam Chair? You know, if you look at other states with multiple state universities, and it seems like they're always on a formula, and so the more students they get, the more their funding goes up. You know, you look at Colorado, you look at Colorado Mesa, Grand Junction, 10,000 students. It's just new buildings, new. It's only growing, University, I think, in Colorado. But I guess to get to the question, how does our dollar per student funding, and our mission's a little different as the smallest state, obviously, in one, but how does our dollar per student compare funding-wise, state aid, compare with other similar universities in our conference or what have you, Colorado State, those kinds of.
Madam Chair, Representative Harshman, I believe you would find that the funding is roughly comparable. What is not the same is the source of the funding. I'm going to say in most public universities today, there is a much higher proportion of the cost that is borne by the students through tuition and fees than there is at the University of Wyoming. At the University of Wyoming, there is a much higher cost that is borne through the Section 1 appropriated side from the legislature. About 45% of our operating budget is provided through appropriation, Section 1 money, if you will. At Colorado State, it's about 22%. At the University of Colorado Boulder, it's about 9%. I think if you sample from the regional comparators or our athletic comparators, you would find that the norm is somewhere in the low to mid-20s. So we're almost double the reliance on appropriation. Those other schools, you would find that 45% is probably closer to what to the amount that tuition handles. On our side, it's much, much lower.
And thank you.
Madam Chair, let me continue with a brief discussion of the governor's recommendations with regard to the 6% reduction. There was a recommendation to reduce the School of Energy Resources budget, which is not part of our block grant. The governor's recommendation was to reduce that portion of our budget by $272,000 or 2.7%. So that recommendation did not follow the 6% reduction scenario. It was less at 2.7%. Yes.
This is maybe a question for you, Madam Chairman. Didn't we do something different with the School of Energy Resources in terms of the block grant last year?
Madam Chair, the School of Energy Resources budget is a separate line in the university's budget, so it is not part of our block grant. But it was moved last year from AML funding to state Section 1 funding.
Okay. With respect to the, this is SER. So SER is over on page 21. So we created a separate expense table for that agency, but so they're funded through the university out of general funds, but they're not within the block grant. So, Mr. President, you're saying that it's ultimately it's a 2.78%?
2.7%.
2.7%. Okay. So then the Representative or Senator Bebout wanted me to ask, is that the SER, does that fund CERDAM's group?
It includes CERDAM's group, yes, sir.
So I guess one of the questions is when SER elected to go through and pick up that faculty and go for, I guess it would be CO2 sequestration, how did the decision make to do that, and where do you see that going in light of some of our other budget, for example, removing some of the funding for the deep well on that was in the and some of those areas. So where is it going? What kind of benefits are we receiving as a state and maybe as a university?
Mr. Chairman, in the 2012 legislative session, recall that the legislature diverted all but $1 million from the Y-CUSP project. The $1 million that was left was in addition to the AML funds that were projected to be spent over the next year and in addition to federal grant funds. Over the past year, the folks in this sequestration project have been adding specificity to what has been general information about the Rock Springs uplift site. They have gathered information about the uplift to convert what they consider high-risk general information to more realistic low-risk assessments. The most important features of the work has been the development of a high-resolution database provided by a 4,000-meter-deep stratigraphic test well, and I can tell you that the work demonstrates that the Rock Springs uplift is an outstanding large-scale CO2 storage site. At this point, the remaining budget is $1.9 million in AML funds and $919,000 in U.S. Department of Energy funds. One more year of research to continue what I have just previously described to close that out is envisioned, and at that point the project will be closed down, if you will, until such time as there's some reason to open that well back up and have discussions about sequestration.
What does that mean with respect to staffing of those on those programs? Is their term limited to funding, or are they?
Mr. Chairman, these are Section 2 employees, which means that their employment lasts as long as the funding is available for their position, and when the funding runs out, they are no longer employed. Now, that is standard for research associates, postdocs, and others who receive funding from research projects and have 100% commitment to research, as opposed to a traditional faculty position, which would be funded on Section 1 dollars and would carry teaching, research, and service commitments.
Thank you. You have this program, then, that has Section 2 funding, carbon underground storage. A lot of that got started when Ron was with the Geological Survey, and at that point he was a director, and he would make presentations to us in terms of the merit of the programming moving forward. If it depends on legislative funding, I guess it's up to him to meet with legislators. There's a mechanism for him to make his case whether the program's worthy of future funding. I guess it's a new bridge to cross.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's a discussion that we may have between now and the submission of our regular budget for the budget session. At this point, I think there's some question about whether or not Director Serdam intends to seek other federal funding or whether or not he intends to retire. I don't know what his intentions are, but it's quite possible that others in his research group might choose to submit federal research proposals consistent with the general nature of the research that they've been conducting and seek to carry on that effort, whether or not it would rise to the priority of a university request to this group remains to be seen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would you explain to us a little bit how you determine whether something is a Section 1 or Section 2? Because I noticed that in your Section 1 description, it includes research as part of Section 1.
Madam Chair, Representative Wallace, the Section 1 budget covers the salaries for all tenured and tenure-track faculty at the university, as well as some academic professionals, a category of employees who work from year to year for the first 6 years and then can be offered an extended term. But for all regular faculty, they are all on Section 1. All of them have job descriptions which require significant teaching, some research, and a little bit of service. There are exceptions to that rule. If you're an extension educator, outreach and instruction would probably be heavier percentages. If you're a chemistry faculty member in the laboratory, research might be more significant than if you're a dance professor, in which case teaching probably would be almost all of your job responsibility. But the Section 1 appropriation is used primarily to cover the costs associated with what we consider to be the permanent instructional workforce of the university. When someone receives a research grant, those grants are always time limited. Those are not permanent employees, and we don't make permanent commitments to individuals who are on arguably non-permanent sources of funding. And I hope I've answered your question.
I think so. But, for instance, the professor that you just mentioned, Dr. Serdum?
Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am.
That person is not a tenured professor, doesn't have any teaching responsibilities?
Madam Chair, I would have to go back and look and see what his title and what his appointment is. He's one of those, I'm going to say, special faculty. I would assume he is not Section 1. Well, he began with being paid from AML funds, but I don't believe he holds tenure. I don't believe he holds a faculty appointment. He is an employee of the Energy School for as long as they need him, and I would assume that at such time as the Y-Cusp project folds up, then Professor Serdum would either be in search of additional funding to keep his employment at UW continuing, or he would step down or whatever career decision he wants to make. Madam Chair, Professor Serdum was a tenured full professor at the university, and he retired a number of years ago and came to work for the state. So he is, a unique example.
Yes. On that topic, with the university employees, they have two categories of retiree or retirement programs. You have those that are in the self-directed defined contribution plan, which would be the TIAA CRAF, and then you have those that have elected to be in the state retirement program. One of the areas that's gotten attention the last year is whether or not an employee can reach the rule of 85 and then go back and back on the job, if you will. Do you see that taking place at the university? Are there folks that are hitting the rule 85, leave for a month or a year, and then come back and elect to continue to take their retirement while they're reemployed?
Mr. Chairman, there have been cases where that has occurred, but I think they are few and far between. I can think of two examples where we have done that. Neither of them recently. I'm going to say a number of years ago, I would guess about 10. We recruited Ken Griffin, who had been the provost at the university and retired. We recruited him to come back out of retirement and serve as interim dean of the College of Business, a position that he held for 2 years while we searched and made decisions about the permanent dean. Ken was an example where we did that.
Let's talk about Ken for a moment.
Yeah. So
Ken, you have an experienced professor who you needed him, apparently.
I mean, we needed him.
You needed him. If he had to have made the election to go off the retirement and come back and then go back on it, do you think you could have recruited him, or do you think that part of the attraction for recruiting him is that he
Mr. Chairman, no, I don't think it was. I think his decision to retire was made months, if not a couple years, in advance of when we approached him.
I understand that. What I'm saying is that when you did approach him and you needed him, and if we changed the statute and said if you go back to work, then you have to stop taking your retirement. You can continue to add to its value, but you stop your retirement. In a person like in that situation, do you think Dr. Griffin would even have been willing to come back and serve the time, or he said, "Look, if I have to stop taking my retirement, I'm not interested"?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure, but I think he would have seriously considered coming back if he could have continued to contribute to his retirement. As we understand, or as I understand the rules, the situation now is if you call someone out of retirement, they continue to draw that retirement payment, but they can no longer contribute into it while they're employed.
Yeah, you contribute on their behalf, but it doesn't add to their years of service. So,
if that were to change, I think, they might be interested. The other example that I can think of was an individual who retired from the university, had no intention of coming back, and that was Jim Steitman, one of the recent directors of the Enhanced Oil Recovery Institute, Dave Morbacher's predecessor. The director of that institute left. We were in a bind. I recruited Jim Steitman to come back and take that position out of retirement. He did come back under the rules that were in place at the time, and he did stay for, 6 or 7 years, and then stepped out of that position. This was not a job he was looking for or interested in. I considered it a favor that he would consider it at the time. Would he have taken it if he could have continued to contribute to his retirement? I think he probably would have.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I have finished with my rundown on the 6% budget reduction impacts and sources. And would move now to two items that we have for our interim budget request. The first one is a salary increase for FY14. Our original request was for $4.9 million, which was a 3% salary increase. The governor's recommendation was for $2.38 million. That includes salary increases for SER. And that $2.38 would be UW's share of the $11 million directed to the executive branch, as noted on the fiscal profile. I think I need to emphasize at this point that it has been UW's tradition for as long as I've been there, and as long as I can remember, that salary increases are awarded on the basis of merit. The governor's recommendation of $2.38 million would be approximately a 1.4% salary increase for faculty and staff. And those funds would be awarded on the basis of merit. On average, they'd represent a 1.4% increase, but some employees might receive 1%, some might receive 1.4, some might receive 2%. And that distribution would be made by the immediate supervisor, as has always been the case, on the basis of yearly performance appraisals, and merit. Individuals with less than satisfactory performance are not eligible for raises.
Doctor, with respect to salaries, we had reached, a couple of years ago, we'd gotten to 91% of market, and it looks like, according to your information, we've slipped down to about 88%, is what it looks like. I think if you would tell us how you determine the market and how you arrived at those different numbers, please.
Mr. Chairman, on the faculty side, there is a study that has been conducted now for 35 years by Oklahoma State. It's conducted every year, and it documents the salaries of every faculty member participating. This would be all of the public universities and colleges in the country, as well as some privates, and it documents salary, by academic discipline, and by rank. So, for example, it would document how much money an assistant professor is being paid at all of the participating schools, calculate summary statistics, and which then provides us the opportunity to aggregate those numbers into comparator groups for us to use to determine market. Now, and I recognize we had this conversation this morning. Having been producing comparator groups for this kind of analysis for 15 years, I understand that one person's appropriate group of comparators is anathema to someone else, and they want to see a different list of comparator groups. We have looked at our salary in relationship to all public land grants. We've looked at it in relationship to all publics. We've looked at it in relationship to regional publics. At the governor's request, we have looked at our market in relationship to those in our athletic conference. In this case, I'm speaking from a comparison of the 50 public doctoral research universities in which we are a member, and we are at 88% of the market. We are or 12% below the average. I can tell you that if I'm, and I would be happy to produce any comparator group that you would find more satisfying, but I would tell you the results will fluctuate 1 or 2 percentage points in either direction. All of the comparisons that we have looked at put us on the order of 10% below market. Sometimes it's 86, sometimes it's 88, sometimes we're at 90. Rarely are we above 90, but I could probably produce one that would show we're at 91% of market. But all of these show us that we have lost some ground. We didn't participate in the 91% market adjustment that the administrative branch participated in a couple years ago. We have lost some ground, and this was part of our rationale for asking for 3%, was rather than dig down into the minutiae, if you will, of how to construct the best comparator to produce a market number, that we would simply make the argument that it has been 3 full years going on 4, and there has been no salary adjustment at the university. We are losing some of our strongest performers, 21 in fact last spring, which represents a 62% increase over the year before. This isn't resignations and retirements or folks we've dismissed. We lost 21 folks to competitive offers from other institutions that we did not want to lose. We're seeing that increase. I would expect to see it again this spring. And that we would ask for a 3% salary increase, recognizing shifts in the cost of living and the market issues, which do show us substantially below average, and the fact that there has been no increase over the last 3 to 4 years. Wyoming cost of living has increased 6.4% since the last raise in FY10.
What was that number again?
6.4%.
Do you have any statistics on the cost of increase of, in the comparative institutions as far as cost of living?
Mr. Chairman, I don't. I suspect we could find that for you if that would be helpful, but we don't have that. I can tell you that even the states that have been hard hit by state budget reductions are continuing to offer salary increases. Colorado State is offered a salary increase last year. They offered a salary increase again this year. They will. And the way they're doing it is through tuition increases. And that has become a common tool for universities that are impacted by state budget reductions is to, I'm going to say, maintain what they have or continue to grow through increases in the cost of attendance. Our cost of attendance, while it has not been completely flat, has been quite close to flat over the last 6 or 8 years, primarily because we've been treated well by you folks, and it's not been necessary. We have had a couple 2% salary increase or tuition increases, but that's about it as of late.
I'll follow up on that. On when you look at page 18 of your budget, your request, that was for 3% that's profiled there, the $4.9 million.
Mr. Chairman, yes, sir.
And then, I mean, in the past, sometimes we've required, we've split it, said pick it up half general fund and half from your other Section 1 tuition. Are there tuition increases scheduled to go into effect in this year or the next year?
Mr. Chairman, there's a 2% tuition increase scheduled to go into effect this coming fall. Those funds have either been the passage of the 2% tuition increase carried with it an endorsement by the student body, primarily because the Board of Trustees made a commitment in advance of passing that increase regarding how those funds would be distributed, primarily those funds going to the library. To the extent that they don't go to the libraries, they are wrapped up in part of our 6% budget reduction. So if I understand, Mr. Chairman, where you're headed with this conversation, I don't think those funds would be available as an offset against the salary a salary request.
Let me follow up with respect to that question. The when we look at your comparator of the 91% and you've got your slippage to 88, were those both from the same analysis with the 15 public doctoral research groups? Or my recollection is in the past we were principally looking at the land grants, and there was actually a name you used to give to us in terms of the institutions which we compared to.
Mr. Chairman, the comparator group that is being used in these documents is 50 public research universities offering four-year degree, I'm sorry, graduate degrees, doctoral degrees. Most of them are members of the Association of American Universities. The list is available. It is primarily made up of institutions which academic affairs and others perceive us to be in, if you will, in competition with, for faculty hires and faculty, not to put it indelicately, raids. A number of them, it includes, if I remember correctly, all of the, I mean, of the 50, it's coast to coast, but it includes most of the principal state institutions in our surrounding states, with the exception of South Dakota, I believe, and then, again, quite a number of others.
The 91 and the 88 are compared off the same comparator list. We didn't change the system.
Mr. Chairman, we've not changed the system. I do have that list here, if it's something you would like.
I think we ought to get that for our record. And then with respect to that comparator list, are benefits calculated in, or is it just raw salary? So.
Yeah.
I mean, we know we have made more contributions to health care insurance. We have this family plan that's pretty where we're paying 80% of the entire family if you have a family.
Yeah.
And then you have the increase in our contribution for retirement. So are those factored into that?
Mr. Chairman, these are straight salaries. They don't include fringe benefits.
Is there any way to know whether or not if you put in the benefits we would still be at 88% or whether we go up or down?
Mr. Chairman, I cannot answer that for you. We would have to survey all 50 of the institutions and try and quantify the dollar value of their benefits compared to ours. Not something we've ever done.
Well, I always wonder is, do you think faculty actually look at those things, or do they look at their raw? I mean, at some point we could say you can offer whatever health care plans you want or retirement plans and to drive up your salary. I'm not proposing we do that, but our belief is, and maybe an unfounded belief, but I think our belief is that our benefits are pretty healthy compared to what surrounding states are offering,
yeah,
both in terms of retirement and health insurance.
Mr. Chairman, I believe faculty we are trying to hire do scrutinize benefits, and I would agree with your characterization. They're considered healthy.
Mr. Chairman, there is one thing you forgot, though. They have to live in Laramie.
Bonus.
Senator Meyer, and then Representative.
Thank you, President McCann. I'm trying to get an understanding about the tuition and salary relationship. So could you tell me what 1% tuition increase would mean in dollars and what a 1% salary increase, mm-hmm, would be in terms of dollars?
A 1% increase in tuition would produce about $500,000. A 1% increase in salary would require about $1.7 million.
Representative Stewart.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. President, go back to your breakout of that 2.38 mil from the governor. Now, is that number from the governor's 11 mil total?
Mr. Chairman, yes, it is.
In addition, then.
If I could correct it,
yeah.
I'll remind you that $2.5 million of that $11 million was one-time funding. My understanding is that the university is not eligible for those one-time funds. So the ongoing pay adjustment is drawn from the $8.5 million pot that the governor set aside.
Right. Thank you,
Madam Chair. That was my next question, and then to follow up, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. Thank you. So, Mr. President, then this pay increase will be applied to faculty and staff.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
And then, Mr. President, I was reading in your budget message there, your last paragraph on page 18. Where you say with the formula you were going to use initially with the $4.9 million that a lot of it would be merit-based and that some people may not get a raise. Will you be applying that same formula, Mr. President?
Madam Chair, Senator or Representative Stewart, I think I would not describe it as a formula. But I think the answer is yes. If we had 1.4% worth of salary dollars to distribute, or 3% worth of salary dollars, or any amount, it would be distributed on the basis of merit. That means some folks would receive the 1.4%. Some might receive less. Those who are not performing satisfactorily would not receive anything. And some might receive more based on their performance and their merit, and that is for both staff and faculty alike. And that's been our historical approach to salary distribution for at least the last 15 years.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I appreciate seeing this analysis with this agency, and maybe perhaps we could direct staff to show us some of the numbers, how this $11 million or the $8.5 and $2.5 is going to be directed to some of our agencies. You know, we just had community college here, and how this budget increase affects their budgets, because we don't see it in their budget when we look through.
Mr. Richards, can you respond to that?
Madam Chair, Representative Stewart, we've asked for that information from the governor's office. He has apparently not distributed, other than UW, which we're finding out now, how much will go to the judiciary branch, how much will go to the community colleges, how much will go to other state agencies at this time. We've asked for that.
So the plan is we should have that when we come back in January?
Madam Chair, I think that's
we can assume
maybe even this week.
Follow-up?
One more follow-up, Madam Chair. And, of course, I don't have my calculator handy. Of course, 2.38 mil, what percent of that is 8.5? And this is to be distributed on a prorated share. And, of course, that seems like a high number. Is that due large part to the fact of high salaries, for instance, found at the university, Mr. President?
Mr. Chairman, I would assume that's largely the result of the fact that we are among the most, if not the most, personnel-intensive large organization that you have in the state of Wyoming. Others that have much of their budget in the benefits that they disperse and are not as personnel-intensive might have budgets equal or larger than ours, but a much smaller workforce.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah. Is that what you need? Okay.
Yeah.
Dr. Buchanan, could we go back to the 21 positions that basically left your institution for other competitive institutions? Is that something that occurred because there wasn't a 3% increase even in their vision, or does it have more to do with the lack of the 12% comparison, you know, between the different regions?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure it has to do with any single calculation. I think it has to do with multiple years of no salary increase, folks who look forward and don't see as bright a future as they're led to believe exists somewhere else, where they are being offered substantial dollar amounts in excess of what we currently pay them, and they decide that their career and their family would be better served by moving somewhere else. Now, on a couple of occasions, these folks were important enough to us and high enough priority that we enter into the fray and we make counteroffers, and one of them, or two of them, actually, we were successful in retaining, but some others we did lose. We lost a good faculty member we didn't want to lose to CU. We kept a good faculty member who was being recruited by the Imperial College in the UK. We kept him by counteroffering, and we will have him for the foreseeable future. But our very best faculty they're in a worldwide job market. And it is, I'm going to say, it's a continuing issue to make sure that they've got the resources they need to do the work that is important to them, and that they see UW and the state of Wyoming as a place where their families and their careers are going to prosper.
And how many years approximately did they have in, or that you had invested in them?
Madam Chair, in the example that I was just speaking about, 10.
10. And that fairly typical of this group that probably exited?
Madam Chair, the most common time to recruit faculty away is, I'd say, 6 to 10 years out, post-tenure, after tenure, but before promotion to full, because that's when I'm going to say you're likely to get the largest impact.
Other questions?
Yeah,
Senator Nicholas?
I'd like to follow up on it. One of the things on the engineering task force that was discussed was you take these prominent faculty members that develop programs, they usually develop a group of grad students, and in essence, the professors develop their own areas of expertise and are often recruited because of that expertise to either grow or start a new program at the other college, and all of a sudden money gets thrown around. And part of the issue was is trying to, in those areas of expertise, make sure that we're having layers of expertise so that you don't lose one professor and then lose the program. Is that a new concept that, or something UWs have never done in the past? Or
Mr. Chair, it is not a new concept. I think it's something that we may have done inadequately in the past, and that's to build the depth to sustain those important areas over time. Too often are in highly important areas of research, we had been a mile wide and an inch deep. Too many areas that we have, were trying to put forward as areas of excellence. I think we have been more circumspect as a result of our strategic planning in identifying and promoting areas and more focused on building depth in recent years. I think we're probably better off today than we've ever been. But in a tight job market where it's a seller's market, we need to make sure that we have the bench depth, if you will, so that losing one individual doesn't bring an important research area to a screeching halt. And that's, in fact, what we have been doing. There are faculty members, if we lost, it would be a significant loss to us, but we would still be able to continue.
Is there a way to know that when we lose faculty to other institutions, whether we're losing them because they have state support that provides greater salaries, or maybe they're, what you described as Section 2, their research dollars are so much greater because they're better at securing federal grants or they have better programs that are funded by private sector, and is that the reason we're losing them? And if that's the case, what do we do to build the programs to pick up those other sources of funds?
Mr. Chairman, I think it's both. And I think we do the same thing our competitors do. And I'll use the example of the individual that was being recruited away from one of the top petroleum programs in the world, Imperial College. And it was certainly salary. We countered with as aggressive a salary offer as we have made in my recollection. That put us in the ballpark, but not light years ahead of what he was being offered elsewhere. And we stepped forward with research support, which was a combination of indirect cost returns from our research enterprise, Section 2, as well as dollars from private donors. And we put together a multi-million dollar laboratory package, and in combination, we have been successful at keeping him here. But short of putting together that type of that's the most aggressive we have ever been with a faculty member that I can recall, but he's right at the point where we think his work is just beginning to receive worldwide acclaim. And we need it here, and we will do everything we can not to lose it. Hess Energy stepped forward with a multi-million dollar gift that will allow him to build the kind of laboratory he needs to take his research to the next level. And right now, he's happy as a clam.
Well, that's so if you compare us to these institutions and their salary bands, if you compare us to our percentage of state support, how do we compare? Or, I mean, maybe their budgets are so out of whack compared to ours that you can't do that. I don't know.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I'm following your question.
Well, I mean, the reason they're offering salaries is because they have more research grants, they have bigger programs, or is it because the states are providing a higher level or higher percentage of state support for the institutions?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think it has to do with the level of support to the state institution. It certainly has to do with the size of the university and the flexibility that comes from operating a university with three times as many students as we have and a budget that's proportionately larger than ours. There's more flexibility in it. But I think those schools are doing the same thing we are, and that's scrambling to find ways to put together financing deals that will attract the best and the brightest, and then to make sure they do everything they can to keep them. And I would tell you that salary is an important component of that. It's not the only one, but it's an important one.
That's where I want to take you next, and that is, so we're looking at the Tier 1 engineering program prepared to make what we described last year as a $100 million investment into facilities and programming at the same time that we're looking at budget constraints. And, you know, my constituents ask, are they consistent or inconsistent? So I'd just ask you to share your views on that.
Consistent or inconsistent, Mr. Chairman?
The facilities and at the same time constraining your operating budget.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think that's inconsistent. I think that's good strategic planning. The University of Wyoming is not a large university. Resources are not limitless. We will not be good at everything. We have to be strategic at where we make our investments, in my opinion, and I think the Board of Trustees supports this. And engineering is one of the areas that we have identified as these are jobs and positions critical to the state and the region. We already have a solid foundation. We can distinguish our entire university if we can elevate the stature of the College of Engineering to what it might be. And I think we would be foolish not to try. Now, there are other parts of the university that I would not say that about. And, you know, I'd prefer not to mention who the haves and have-nots are directly, but there are other parts of the university that will not grow, that we are not aggressively recruiting private money for, seeking help from the state for facilities and resources. This is an investment that makes good sense. I think I will say social and behavioral sciences is not an area that we're putting huge investments of dollars into. It does not produce the direct workforce needs for the state and the region. It's not connected to the industries that drive the state economy. Engineering is, I'm going to say the stars are aligned for us to step forward, not just with the facility, because it's really what happens inside the facility that matters. So I'm going to say, while our last request and our largest capital construction request that I'm aware of we've ever made comes not only with a big price tag, but also I hope with the recognition that we will have to invest in a sustained way dollars to support program development and faculty enhancement if we're going to elevate the College of Engineering to the Tier 1 status that we've been directed to.
Now, with respect to the engineering dollars, we put those in the treasurer's office to build up the fund. And if the governor's recs are to hold and we approach the targeted $100 million, the next question is when do we begin releasing the funds, whether we wait till we see what the engineering task force comes back with, a recommendation, then appropriate it, or whether we create a trigger that allows those funds to release to move forward. And I'd like to know what your thoughts are on, I mean, how to, from the legislative point of view, if we're interested in making sure that the task force completes their work, gets their recommendations, what would be an appropriate triggering event to allow the expenditures, or should we just wait another year and see how it all shakes out?
Mr. Chairman, the task force report is at the printer. We expect that it will be finished and on the governor's desk within the week. So I think in the not-too-distant future, once the governor has received it and I've got copies out to my board, I think we'll post it to the web and it will be available to anyone that would like to see it. I think the task force has been rightly insistent that there are a series of recommendations that they are making in their report. Most of their recommendations are programmatic and relate to programs and faculty resources. I think having participated on that task force, I am in agreement with the recommendations that they have made about improvements that need to occur in the College of Engineering. The task force asked the governor at the last meeting if it could continue its work rather than disband, despite the fact that the report had been completed. I believe they have asked, and there is some effort being made to schedule the members of the task force to come to Cheyenne during the legislative session to meet with an appropriate group of legislators to talk about their report and the work that they think needs to be done before we progress. And I think that would be, it would be at least at that point, if not longer, before any movement should occur on the part of the college. I think there is there are recommendations in the task force report that pertain directly to the kinds of resources and facilities that the college will need in the future. I think it probably is a minimum of a year off, regardless of whether or not the funds are set aside, before we have a good sense of the kinds of facilities that we'd be talking about and the dollar amounts. So I think while there is work, preliminary work that could be done, it's going to take some action on the part of the College of Engineering to get its itself rolling before we would want to move forward with that project.
What I think you've already been doing some tier or level one studies for space allocations and some preliminary work. Is a task force proposing that they have an opportunity to participate in that level one, level two, and reexamine it? Or and maybe the question is, when you go to the next level of planning, are they wanting to be involved in it? How do you integrate them with your faculty? Has that been discussed?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, there has been no indication from the task force that they want to be directly involved in the level two planning. There has been an indication that they want to see evidence that the College of Engineering is making progress towards the goals that they have set in the task force report. And I think, for example, one of the recommendations would be for the College of Engineering, this comes as no surprise, the College of Engineering to identify 3 to 5 niche areas of expertise to build its research strength in, and to focus its research dollars and resources on those 3 to 5 areas, not to spread itself a mile wide and an inch deep. I think in order to do that, the college is going to have to identify what those areas are, assess its own current resources, look to the resources it would need to build the kind of strength in those areas necessary to achieve that Tier 1 status, and then incorporate that information in the design of the new facility to make sure that we're not building a $100 million facility following last year's vision. So I see this as a process that's going to take a year, if not longer.
I guess what I'd like is some help, and maybe what you, Chris and Mike, can give us help in terms of developing language for a trigger, so that if you want to trigger your level two design work, what's the trigger for cutting it loose? You also have the issue, if you're out matching funds, do you match the funds and they stay in the treasurer's account and your match goes in the treasurer accounts, or do they come out of the treasurer accounts? And just the mechanics of how we do that. I mean, oftentimes we parked it over with UW and just let you run. I think the task force is wanting to hold the money back a little bit and make sure that everybody's on board together, which is okay, mm-hmm. but then we either wait for a year or we have some triggering events to keep the process moving at the same time let the executive branch as well as the task force have some input.
Mr. Chairman, we need to remember a couple of things in all this. First of all, there are two projects that are wrapped up in the approaching level two studies. That's both the High Bay facility, the energy engineering research facility, as well as the potential engineering project. I think there's a recognition that the two projects may not move forward at the same rate, but at the same time, both of them are wrapped into the same level two components in terms of design and planning and the rest. The High Bay facility, I'm sure engineers would blanch at my description, but it's a little more generic and requires perhaps a significantly less UW-specific planning and design than one might expect in the engineering building. So I think there is a need for the level two to proceed with on the High Bay facility, and they will in some fashion proceed in concert.
Already appropriated, though it's a different appropriation than the college expansion, right?
Correct, Mr. Yeah. Chairman. The High Bay has $15 million, rough. I think it's exactly $15 million that's being raised from private sources by the university, and then $15 million in state match.
Mr. Chairman, I believe so.
Well, now with those AMLs, would they have already been swapped out, or do you know? It's not a big deal.
Mr. Chairman, we've not been anticipating swapping the AML funds.
Okay, thanks.
At what point do you start doing the research then to look at those niches that you want to specify in, and then how do you correlate that with how much it's going to cost you for professors and going about the programming, yeah. and how do you fund for that?
Madam Chair, that's work that's already begun. It just has not been clearly articulated by the college. I think there is not unanimity, but there is probably a large majority of folks in the college that would identify, if asked, would identify at least three areas that would be commonly recognized as niche areas that they should pursue. Unconventional reservoirs, for example, I expect to see as one of the niche areas. Composite materials is another one that I expect to see in the College of Engineering. And it may be that they only choose to identify 3 to 5, but we already have strength. We already have work going. It's more a matter of making the commitment to elevate these to priority areas that will continue to receive institutional support and resources regardless of year-to-year fluctuations and budget discussions we might have with you folks.
All right. So it's about maintenance and enhancing existing programs? I mean, is that
a way
partly to look at it? Okay. Other questions on the School of Engineering? How about the design? Could we have an update on that? I know someone here had an opinion this summer about what the front looked like. About the new building. Mm-hmm. Yeah. STEM building. Yeah.
STEM.
Oh.
I'm sorry
Madam,
to jump ship, but I wanted to know.
Madam Chairman, the interactions continue. There has been significant interaction with interested parties in the Laramie community and elsewhere. I think the design is largely on track. The groundbreaking is expected to occur this spring. There have been suggestions made, in particular about the look of the exterior of the building. It's been a safe to say, healthy back and forth. The architects, I believe, have been, and I haven't been directly involved in many of these discussions, but the architects have been pretty receptive to consideration of moving some things around and changing the what I call the aesthetics, although that's perhaps not the most accurate way of describing it. And I think we're getting to the point now where there is a very good likelihood of a meeting of the minds with the folks that are involved, and that this thing can proceed potentially this spring.
Madam Chair, I can give you some specifics. Level one has been completed. Level two has been completed and submitted to the state and is awaiting final approval. The CMAR has been selected for pre-designed services, including a guaranteed maximum price. In March, A&I will determine whether to continue with the CMAR or with a general contractor and a design bid approach. As Chris mentioned, we are working out the final details of the exterior finish of the structure, but that appears to be going quite nicely. Groundbreaking is scheduled in late May or June, and an expected opening in 2015.
Good. And Representative Harshman?
Madam Chair, just had a question just about your bonding authority, not to shift gears too much on colors of buildings and all those things, but it does kind of relate to that. And if you could give the committee a little information on, you know, how fully you are bonded out. Really, what does your capacity mean in dollars? And then how does that compare to other comparable institutions? I mean, we're a pretty conservative state. I would guess that your bonding authority is relatively low, but I don't know that. I'd like to know more about it.
Mr. Chairman, I can do that. Right now we have $108.5 million in total debt outstanding, and we have an additional $24.38 million in projected net pledged revenue based upon the authorizations to move forward with projects from last session. We have $8.38 million per year as average annual debt service, and we have a projected debt service coverage ratio. The ratio of bondable revenues coming into the university by debt service of 2.9. If we survey, and we have recently surveyed about a dozen regional comparators, the median comparator group debt service coverage ratio is 2.8, so we are above that. That is a policy that the Board of Trustees established about 3 years ago, that when they were making decisions about borrowing funds for building at the university, that they would not allow the debt service coverage ratio to drop below the median of comparator institutions, which they have not done. And recall that the minimum ratio for debt service coverage that is required for the supplemental bond coverage by the state of Wyoming is 2.5. So we're at a ratio now of 2.9. So we have 2.9 times the revenue coming in that we have debt service for the bonds that we've issued. I would tell you that I don't anticipate that the Board of Trustees will entertain any additional bond issuance until that ratio moves upward into the threes, and that can happen either through growing a larger enterprise at the university, either through tuition revenues or other sources, or by paying down the bonded indebtedness that we presently have.
And then to follow up, just are any of those, are you close to knocking out any debts you've been working on, or is it a process you kind of keep rolling it?
Mr. Chairman, we have wraparound debt financing. I'm going to say the short answer is it will be a number of years before we have any capacity to eliminate substantially the debt that we currently owe.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
couple things on that. One is the on the debt service. So we changed the statute to allow you to pledge some of our AMLs with respect to in order to enhance the bond ratings. And then we learned 3 or 4 months ago that your bond counsel from Denver had changed that so that the state would actually have to advance. We would advance the payments by about $5 million before you had to pay the payments. And I think we sent a letter saying, look, that was never our intent. It's one thing to offer additional collateral, if you will, for the loans, but to propose that the state's going to advance your payments was far outside what we had intended. What's been the resolution of that issue?
Mr. Chairman, I would like to ask Janet Lowe, our Vice President for Fiscal Operations and Administration, to respond.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We are in the process of amending the Memorandum of Understanding with the State Treasurer to remove that restriction on the FMRs. We plan to deposit either FMRs or other pledged revenue with the state in order that that restriction can be removed.
So what you're saying is the obligation to make the prepayments will exist, but the university is going to make them instead of the state.
That's exactly correct.
I guess one of the things I'm curious of what I got to be honest, I don't understand how QTAC Rock even puts that requirement in there. I mean, it doesn't take much to know that when they put a requirement for the state to prepay a payment, that I don't know whether they're representing the bondholders or the issuer, but it's pretty extraordinary that they even put that in there in the first instance. And how did it get in there, and how does it were QTAC serving as the issuing authority or the bond, or they're representing the bondholders?
They represent the university as our bond counsel. I believe they put that in to give the Standard & Poor's and the Moody rating agencies a greater level of comfort.
Well, we could pledge the entire state, and
Standard
& Poor's would love that.
Yes, that's correct.
But, so, I mean, you would think that QTAC, if they put that in there, would have to talk to somebody and said, hey, we're going to do this. Did they not talk to anybody? They just put it in without talking to you all?
No, we sat down with the State Treasurer's Office, QTAC Rock, our investment bankers, George K. Baum and Company, and crafted that MOU.
So the Treasurer understood that he was going to have to come and ask for a $5 million appropriation from us?
I believe that's true, yes.
Wow. Well,
we are in the process of amending that MOU to remove that restriction.
All right,
making sure that the Standard & Poor's folks understand the impact of that and it doesn't negatively affect our bond rating, as you put in your letter.
Okay, and that's the other issue is that I'm surprised that the legislation even allowed or contemplated that. Do we need to go back and amend that legislation so it doesn't happen again? I mean, how did the legislation allowed you to offer up as additional collateral some of our bonding, but never, I mean, I don't know by what authority even the Treasurer would have to offer up an appropriated sum without a statutory authority. So if QTAC, part of what they do is they say somebody's got authority to make payments. They would have gone to the legislation and said, well, it looks to us like the state intended to offer up prepayments. If that statute provides that level of discretion, if you will, that needs to be revised. So, and this maybe go back to Mike and to Chris, is whether you examine the legislation, whether we need to amend it so we don't do this again.
I would defer to Chris on that if there needs to be legislative changes. What I would also point out is that the supplemental coverage program is effective through November of 2015. And as Tom pointed out, the university doesn't plan to issue any more debt under the program.
It's time limited.
Pardon me?
It's time limited?
The program itself, yes. We can only apply for supplemental coverage through November of 2015. And again, we have no plans at the moment to issue any other debt. But certainly if the legislation needs to be changed, I'm sure Chris and Mike would be happy to look at that.
Well, let's take an examination. Don, I don't know. I think our examination is we didn't understand by what authority QTAC would even written it in. And that's sort of our view of it. I'm surprised that even the Treasurer cannot block or make a commitment, even if they authorize the issuance of the bonds or signs them. There still has to be statutory authority for us to appropriate money. So I guess our position is it was unauthorized. If you believe it's different, then please let us know so we can change the legislation. The other area I would like to take the opportunity is you mentioned construction manager at risk for the NZ building. I believe that there are some disagreements between you and construction management. Cathcart's group as to which is the best construction delivery method. You guys, all the new members, might as well start getting the doctrination. If you would, please explain why the university would like to do the CMR process, and as best you can, explain Cathcart's position as to why he thinks a different delivery method is a more appropriate.
Mr. Boswell.
Madam Chairman, I think the intent is to engage a CMAR or the CMAR process for pre-design, and that the final determination on the construction delivery method for the building itself is still to be determined. Mr. Cathcart is quite adamant that it will be a design bid build project. Those discussions continue, but ultimately, Madam Chairman, the funding for the NZ STEM facility flows through ANI, and ultimately he holds the keys to the castle, and he's been quite firm. Again, no final decision has been made, but the CMAR was seen as a reasonable effort for pre-design. The attraction for CMAR is that you get a guaranteed maximum price. Frankly, that's one of the very attractive elements of CMAR. It's all debatable, without a doubt. If I can offer sort of the dangerous layman's perspective, Madam Chairman, design bid build frequently turns out to be a long series of interactions between the owner and the contractor. CMAR tends to be, if I dare say it, a cleaner relationship, because you have the guaranteed maximum price. It would be, and he was here earlier, I don't know if Mr. Cathcart is nearby, I think he would suggest that there's a greater opportunity for savings or lower cost with the design bid build process. That, again, is debatable, but I think that would be his assertion.
Representative Moniz and then Representative Parchman.
When you said that the desirable would be a CMAR, desirable on whose part? The contractor or the state or the university or whom?
Mr. Boswell.
Madam Chairman, I think that's going to depend on the circumstance. In this case, a CMAR for the initial design work has been generally seen as a good idea by all parties. That this is very preliminary work. We aren't talking millions of dollars in this. CMAR, obviously, if you are the contractor who's fortunate enough to attain that and be chosen as a construction manager at risk, The positive is that you essentially know what you're going to be paid for a project. The negative is that you have to control the cost to stay under that guaranteed maximum price, which is the typical component of a CMAR. Frankly, Representative, I haven't been doing this all that long, but you hear persuasive arguments that change over the course of the years in terms of what's a good idea, what is the term of art's probably the wrong way to describe it, but the current preferred method changes over years. And there are legitimate disagreements between folks about what the best method is. And you will have folks look you in the eye and tell you that Rich Cathcart is wrong on this. And other folks will look you in the eye and say that he has absolutely the right approach. These construction delivery methods are have their own advocates, if you will, sometimes within the same segment of consideration, meaning the contractors and such. Some of them like them, some of them don't. It just varies, and it's been surprising how much it varies over the years in the various hats that I've worn over the years.
And is it Representative Harshman has a question?
Just an update on the Arena Auditorium project.
Madam Chair, mm-hmm. With regard to the Arena Auditorium, recall that in 2012 there was a $10 million appropriation in matching funds. These were AML funds that were swapped for general funds eventually to be matched with $10 million in private contributions. And at that time, in the language, it said with an equal amount in UW bonding. State funds would not be available by our read of the language in that legislation until all of the $10 million in private contributions had been received and the bonds had been issued. One of the problems that we see is that prospective contributors for that project won't donate if they believe that state funds won't be received for years. I'm going to say that to us contradicts the statutory provisions, the past practice, if you will, of receiving the state match as contributions of more than $25,000 are received. And we would ask this group for consideration to make that modification so that we can match gifts as they are received. We would need legislation that amended the 2012 language to mirror the provisions of the UW Athletics Challenge Fund, and we've got the citation and particulars on that, if that is acceptable to this group. The proposed work, phase one, would be an expansion of the court in the Arena Auditorium, rotating it 90 degrees to create two practice courts, reconfiguration and replacement of seating around the base of the Arena Auditorium, renovation of locker rooms, new technology, new scoreboards, the like, and ADA access. We estimate this phase one to be about $12 million total, with our intention being $6 million in state matching funds and $6 million in private contributions with no bonding necessary. These are independent phases, so we can do phase one without doing phase two. Phase two would be an addition to the east side of the Arena Auditorium with new entrances and concourses, a Hall of Fame and club area. We estimate that at about $18 million. And I'm going to say without the near-term availability of UW bonding, the funding for that phase two is up in the air at this point in time. The governor made no recommendations in his budget with regard to the project.
Okay, so we'll get that language, Madam Chair, that, and I think that was our intent, to kind of have it like we've always done. It's been so successful, folks get excited at the prospect of their donation can be, in fact, power equalized, doubled. So I think we'll work on that.
Madam Chairman, we see no other than the hard work that will go into it. We don't see any significant problem standing in the way of raising the $6 million and matching it in the next year or two.
It seems to Dr. Buchanan that if you're doing it in stages, that would be appropriate, that if you're doing one project at $12 million and you move forward, that you could do it that way pretty easily. Okay. Are there any other questions or comments on the UW's budget? Senator Von Flader.
I'm not quite sure where we are on this, but in regards to the footnote on the bottom of the breakdown on the cost, page 30, on the cost of the engineering school, there is a request of $14.2 million not to have a match to it. Is this, and the governor, I didn't see addressing it, so I'm curious if you have any thoughts on that.
Madam Chairman, the legislature, as you know, set aside $30 million last year for the engineering facility. That was in two pots, one of $15.8 million, one of $14.2. Both the language for both of those appropriations includes the term matching, and the university's read is that the legislative language suggests that there is a need to match the full $30 million that were in, that was incorporated in those two appropriations. Subsequent discussion suggests that perhaps that was not the the intent of the legislature, to be requiring $30 million in what we might call a private fundraising for the university. And that is why, Senator, there had been a request to perhaps separate those two appropriations, that the university would match the $15.8 million but not be required to match the $14.2
million. Follow-up?
What I'm assuming, Chris, is we'll put all the money into one account, create the triggers as to when, what you can take out when for phase two, and then address the matching as well. So this would rewrite the program. But I think what we want to do, what I wasn't certain, is when you get the grant or the match, I don't know. I suppose you don't know now whether it's going to be a match towards the programming or the facility. And we haven't decided yet whether the whole $100 million is programming or facility or part programming. And so as you craft legislation for us, I assume you're going to put it into a we'll put it into a, essentially all in the same spot in the treasurer's office. And then if a gift is made that you want to match, I guess the question is, do you pop the money out and you hold it until it's ready to be used, or whether the money, the match goes into the big fund? But you have the, you have those issues to decide. And at this point, I don't think you've decided, or the committee or the governor has not decided, how much is building, how much is programming. And so that's what I'm not sure whether we're going to get it all done this year. But in the meantime, if you can get matches, we'd want you to get as many matches as you can, and it may be that the donors will decide whether they're giving towards buildings or programs.
Madam Chairman, I think the typically the way these funds are pursued, the donors would be fairly approached with some specificity in terms of what they would be supporting, whether it would be bricks and mortar or equipment or programs within. Madam Chairman, this might be a time to go to the governor's recommendation on the use of GE AML funds for the engineering rebuild. And all I have to do is remember where my notes are, Madam Chairman, but who needs notes? Madam Chairman,
right.
the
used them all
as you know, in the way of background, the legislature directed the university to come up with a plan to work towards a Tier 1 status for the College of Engineering and Applied Sciences. In addition, there was the legislative language which recommended renovation and construction, new construction of the engineering facilities on campus, specifically those related to the College of Engineering and Applied Sciences, and forecast, if you will, or proposed an overall cost of $100 million. The legislature, as we've just discussed, set aside $30 million in funding. As we are proposing it, Madam Chairman, the university would raise another $15 million. the governor has, and actually the university's request was for $60 million in capital construction funds to take the proposed project cost to an estimated $105 million, if I remember right, 105.8, Madam Chairman. Madam Chairman, I think we all understand the circumstances that existed when the $100 million proposal was made. AMLs hadn't been swiped at that point. The university recognizes that a $60 million ask is not a small ask, and there was a recognition that even though the request was for general funds, that there might be other alternatives, since this university suggested that perhaps it would take 2 years to completely fund a $105 million proposal. Madam Chairman, the governor has proposed a couple of funding efforts for the engineering building, and I would hope that somebody would jump in and correct me if I have these wrong, but Madam Chairman, I believe the governor recommended $30 million in general funds towards the construction of the engineering building, and then a $40 million swap of funds. These are AML funds that were a part of what is a total of $51.05 million in AML funds that were directed towards the university's partnership with General Electric for the High Plains Gasification Project. That project, I would emphasize, is on hold. There is not much anticipated movement in the near term. The university does have is committed to a total of $8.05 million in funding for the initial work of the High Plains Gasification Center. What the governor has done is proposed to take $40 million out of that $51.05 million, direct it into the university's budget, and is asking that the university identify $40 million in our general, in some portions of our general fund appropriation, and direct those general funds towards the College of Engineering project. That may or may not be clear after that description, Madam Chairman, but in a nutshell, with a couple of bounces, you've got $30 million in general funds and $40 million in AML funds. That would the latter being poured into the university's budget, and a like amount, $40 million, being taken out of the university's budget. Madam Chairman, that is a very, very substantial amount of money to pull from the university's budget in one fiscal year and replace with AML funds. AML funds, of course, come with certain restrictions. It would not be a simple process to swap out the full $40 million. At the same time, I don't want to suggest that it can't be done.
Well, I assume that we expand the swap to include YDOT, like we did. We didn't have any problem doing the last swaps when we bring in YDOT, do we?
Madam Chairman, I'm not sure that YDOT. Mr. Chairman, are you referring to the $50 million in AML funds or in general funds that YDOT received as part of the 13-14 budget?
Well, I'm suggesting that, I mean, how we do the swap is they can swap out cash for highway projects. So we identify a highway project, they use their AMLs for that, and then they replace and deposit that money into the to the auditor's account for the engineering, and we authorized that swap last year with YDOT, and we did it on which project? We did it on a significant project. I think actually the AA was a YDOT swap, so and they've got plenty of swapping capacity, so when we do the swap, we'll continue that YDOT capacity, and assuming that you don't have the physical capacity to do those large swaps.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, that would help a whole lot.
Well, and that will work with Don to get Richards to get the language for the swaps, assuming the committee recommend or follows. Either way, we need to get all that language developed. And that's language we can begin developing in the next couple of weeks before we come back in January.
Representative Stewart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Chris, the total appropriation then this year is $70 million going towards the engineering building.
Madam Chairman, the governor's recs are $70 million towards the College of Engineering.
And follow-up, of course, then, looking at your budget here, you only requested 60. So basically you're going to end up with $10 million in excess of what you asked for, or what about that $10 million? Do you need that, or explain that gap there?
Madam Chairman, governor's task force has been doing its work, there's been recognition that figures may go higher than $100 million. Again, it was the legislature's instruction to come up with a $100 million proposal, which the university has done. I think there is some consideration being given. The university is involved in some of that discussion, but it's also externally driven to perhaps pursue a more vigorous construction proposal, and also as Mr. Co-Chair was discussing earlier, a component of this that has to do with programs that is also at some point going to be incorporated into all of this. The short answer to your question is yes, it would, if the university raises $15 million, it would take the available funds to $115 million, yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I haven't been involved in the discussions or probably kept up on the reading that I should be, but what's the deal with GE and the High Plains coal gasification? Why is it on hold?
Madam Chairman, I'll offer the layman's perspective, which usually gets me in trouble. Madam Chairman, to a significant degree, the GE interest in a dry feed system has morphed to some degree, and the term of art now seems to be a slurry system. As such, and that pretty much exhausts my technical expertise, Madam Chairman. But the suggestion is that the project, as it was originally envisioned in terms of the technology that would be explored, to a significant degree, the technology may have moved away from that. At this point, Madam Chairman, there is still a considerable interest in making sure that any relationship with GE involve the use of technology which is beneficial for Powder River Basin coal, and that continues. There is a continued legal relationship and potentially a research relationship between the university and GE, which again would remain focused on Powder River Basin coal and these, in particular, potentially the slurry-based delivery method. It's counterintuitive to me that you'd put this stuff in water and then turn it into something, but obviously the engineers know how to do this. Madam Chairman, there would be a remaining balance, if you will, of a few million dollars, not very many, three to be exact, $3 million out of the 51.05 in AML funds that were appropriated to the university for the High Plains gasification project. There are suggestions, and there is an agreement in the works which would use that balance, or proposes to use that balance in a relationship with GE, and for continued coal research associated with the University of Wyoming. And there would be a GE matching component to any state appropriation of AML funds for this research. That is not yet signed, sealed, and delivered, but it has been agreed to in concept.
So I guess the obvious question is, what did we get for our $51 million?
That's why we're getting it back for the engineering college.
Madam Chairman, if I may, I do not completely agree with the Senate Chairman. We have committed $8.05 million, but the remainder has not been spent. What did we receive for that money? It was the initial design and research work for the High Plains gasifier. We were in a contractual obligation with GE that we would essentially split many of the costs 50-50. There are some additional costs that the university was responsible for, liable for, separate from those joint costs. But we have contractual obligation. It's clearly defined. The figures are have been agreed to, if you will, by the parties in terms of what were allowable costs and what were not. It was an extensive document. And that research did take place over the past few years in the sort of an initial planning work in that direction. It's if I remember correctly, a $100 million project. It's, it comes with significant upfront costs. And that's where those funds were dedicated.
I understood during a conference call that they said they were not going to bill us for that half. So I think there was $14 to $15 million spent. Have they billed us for the half, or?
Madam Chairman, I believe I believe General Electric expects to receive those true up funds. Yes, I think there is the opportunity, though, moving forward. And I think General Electric is interested in this as well. Their accountants need that true-up money. That is the, again, informal way that I'm describing this. And yet General Electric remains interested in a continuing partnership with UW for coal research. And there's probably a more artful way of describing this, but they would commit certain GE funds going forward to this research. So the true-up, I believe, for the accountants needs to happen. But at the same time, there's the opportunity for a continued relationship with both parties investing, if you will.
So do we have a sense of what that continued relationship might be focused on? Is it going to be focused on Powder River Basin coal? Is it going to be shifted to something else? What's that going to look like?
Madam Chairman, it would be focused on the slurry-based delivery method, with an expectation that it would be applicable for Powder River Basin coal. Madam Chairman, before I describe a slurry as everybody thinking back to Etsy, and here we go to Texas with a whole bunch of Wyoming water, this is an internal aspect, and slurry is in some fashion the term of art. We aren't picking it up and moving it across state lines with water or anything like that. This is all within the equipment, if you will.
So we didn't get a coal gasification plant. We're getting some kind of a slurry technology thing, and down the road might be a coal gasification plant. GE did all of the work, and now they're billing us for half of it. they kind of reneged on the first part of the deal, but maybe they'll show up for the second part if down the road. Is that kind of a characterization of that? Is that a fair statement or?
That's a fair statement of your characterization.
Is it a fair statement of my characterization? What about you know? I'm just trying to figure this out because it sounds like we got you know. We got a quarter of a tank of gas to make the whole trip, and somebody's going to promise to come out from the station someday and give us another 5 gallons. I don't know.
I think global economics was actually a part of this whole decision process, if I'm not mistaken.
Sure.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'll answer that.
Yeah.
I think we worked alongside of General Electric to design right up to the edge of the construction phase, a coal conversion plant, and we spent a fair amount of UW money doing that, a fair amount of AML funds doing that. General Electric contributed a lot of their time and effort and their resources to do the same as we did this together. When we looked at the balance sheets, they'd spent about 8, we'd spent about 4. So to true it up, we owe them about 4. What we wind up with for all of this is some pretty a great-looking design for a coal conversion plant that we're not going to build. And that leaves a significant amount of money that was originally appropriated that would have been used for the construction of the plant that the governor is now recommending be diverted, a little bit of it maintained to keep an engineer or keep a research operation going between GE and UW. But the bulk of it, he's recommending, go to this funding swap so it could be used for the College of Engineering.
This gets down to, you say, we have a design to build a plant. Now, do we have it, or is it restricted to GE can only build a plant, or is that something that's marketable? And was there a breach of contract, I guess? That's two questions. First question, do we actually own a design that we could sell to somebody else, or are we restricted from marketing that design? Then, two, was there a breach of contract?
Let me start with the latter, and then I'll move to the forward. No, there was no breach of contract. In fact, there were decision points through this project, go, no-go decision points. And at one of those decision points, General Electric notified the state of Wyoming that it wanted to put the project on hold. It did not want to move forward. That was 18 months ago. And it said due to the lack of a national energy policy and due to the uncertainty of the future of coal, we're not prepared to move forward with this project. We're going to wait until the next election when there's clarity. But there was no breach on their part. Some of the components of the project that have been designed thus far are proprietary. They belong to GE, and that was part of the deal all along. So there may be parts of the design that we have, but the number of folks building coal conversion power plants is pretty limited. We haven't looked into that. I can certainly ask that and get you more information on it, but at this point it hasn't moved anywhere.
The other appropriation we put in was for the advanced alternative. So there was, a million or maybe a $3 million first part, a $9 million second part. I've forgotten what the exact. And my recollection is the winning firm was a Eastern company doing bug technology. They put together a plan. And the last I had heard is that the director of SER had looked at it and said this wasn't what we intended to buy. What's the status of that? And I think there's still $9 million left, and
what are the constraints on it?
Great. Madam Chairman, the $9 million has not been spent, so that's still available. I'm thinking that
it's not EORI. This is the Advanced Energy Conversion Task Force, which is the SER board wearing a different hat.
Right.
$9 million. If we're talking about the same thing, Madam Chairman, it's the $9 million that was appropriated to the governor's office.
First was to do a study to see if we could do it. So it was the idea we'd do a study, and they went ahead and went out on bids. It went to the bug company, and what I don't know is whether we ever paid the bug company. Goes back to the same discussion that we just had. Why are we researching proprietary technology? GE, I understand, but this one, and as I understood, there was a dispute. Has that been resolved, or?
Madam Chairman, if I believe what we're talking about is $500,000 that was appropriated. It has been through the School of Energy Resources. Two entities were selected. And that's where we are. I know that one moves forward. I think the second one is moving forward as well. These are smaller entities that all of this was vetted through the SER board. And the short answer is you may be getting a little more for your money than Senator Meyer described earlier in terms of this $500,000. But recognize, Madam Chairman, that when we talk about $500,000 and $9 million, potentially that's a drop in the bucket in terms of what might be needed in order to make some of these processes marketable and functional.
Well, I guess what I'd like you to do is confer with the governor's office on the $9 million, and let's decide whether or not, if the governor, I think, was thinking he wants to keep the dollars available, but let's put more constraints on it, figure out what it is we're wanting. If, for example, the bug technology company thought they had access to the $9 million, I don't think that's what we had in mind. We were looking for gas to liquids or something like that, which I have no idea where it's anybody's even pursuing that. It's sort of on the coal issue, but just if that technology is not moving forward, then we ought to have some overall plan, because otherwise the SER staff's deciding where our $9 million is going instead of the legislature. So let's look at what that language is, whether it continues to meet the objectives of what the executive branch is, and make sure that we understand the direction it's going.
Madam Chairman, I believe the SER board recognized that no one was ready for this $9 million component. I only attended one or two of their meetings, but I didn't get the sense that they were out shopping this $9 million. There was a recognition that there was nothing on the immediate horizon that would rise to this level.
On the UW's budget, is there anything else that we need to address or have questions on? We still have the WICHE budget and the enhanced oil recovery.
And the medical education.
And medical education. So I would recommend we're scheduled to be done at 3, so we're behind schedule. I see that we have the AG's office here. Let's take a 10-minute break. We've been sitting for too long. Come back and complete your budget. Thank you, sir. All right, Mr. President Buchanan, we have, I believe, now Wichee Unit Agency 69? Or did you want to go with?
Correct.
Yeah, all right.
The Wichee is budget 069. The general fund appropriation for this budget is $2.59 million. UW's proposed 8% reduction was $207,229. The governor's recommendation was no reduction. Let me give you just a little bit of background. Presently, we send approximately 110 Wyoming students each year to participating member institutions in seven fields that are not offered by UW. That's a cost of $20,400 per student. The fields include physical therapy, occupational therapy, optometry, podiatry, osteopathic medicine, and the physician's assistant program. I would remind you that beginning next year, Wichee will have a payback provision with the exception of vet medicine, which is the seventh program, and which will mean that we should get the majority of these folks returning to Wyoming to practice.
Any questions on the governor's recommendation?
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairman?
Senator Hastert.
yes, thank you, Mr. President Buchanan. Just elaborate a little more on that Wichee. That's something that I know, as I recall, it's not traditional that we've had the payback, and so we'll be starting that, and that'll be for all disciplines except for
vet med.
Veterinarians.
Right.
Okay. And then the Wichee program is, you know, so if someone getting into physical therapy, attend a college.
Yeah. Let me give you a little bit of background. Wichee stands for the Western Interstate Commission for Higher Education. It consists of a variety of services offered to states, but the one which carries the budget responsibility with it is called the PSEP, Professional Student Exchange Program. There are 15 member states in the Wichee organization that's been in place. It's an interstate compact, has been in place for 60 years. The PSEP program allows us to identify areas of study that we don't offer at UW. And we can make those areas of study available to students by having them apply to any school in the other 14 Western states that offer that program of study. They have to apply as regular students, and if they are accepted, they can attend that other school and pay in-state tuition. And the state of Wyoming makes up the difference between in-state and out-of-state tuition. This is a long-standing program, and it was one that began as an access program. It was designed to allow students to study in areas that we didn't offer at UW. Over the years, a number of states have begun to view this as a workforce development type of a program, and have added to the PSEP the same type of payback provision as we have with our medical education and our dental education programs. The legislature last year passed that stipulation, gave us a year grace period, and beginning next year, students that enroll in one of these programs will sign a contract when they enter one of these programs, that says at the end of their degree program, they can pay back with interest the money that the state has put up for them to study in these areas, or they can return to Wyoming and practice. If they do so for 3 years, the state will forgive the loan. Now, your legislation made an exception and excluded veterinary medicine from the payback provision. And I think the logic was simple. There has been a 100% return rate to practice vet medicine in Wyoming of the individuals who've participated historically in this program.
Madam Chairman, is there any restrictions on WICHE? And forgive me if my my memory here are, you know, that if you have a student that went to a community college, transferred to the university, finished their studies, applies to the university for physical therapy, has all of their, you know, necessary requirements met to enter into physical therapy, they had attended the community college first. Is there any reason that WICHE doesn't apply there?
No, WICHE would apply there. In fact, WICHE applies to any resident of the state of Wyoming, whether they're currently attending a community college or the University of Wyoming. So someone can be attending out of state a college or university. If they live in the state, they're entitled to apply and participate in WICHE. UW provides the administrative services to administer this, but it's a program that's available to anyone who's a resident of the state of Wyoming.
Any other questions on WICHE? President Buchanan, do you have any?
I'll move on to the last of our budgets, the 167 UW Medical Education budget. I will give you the minute and a half synopsis, and then I'm happy to visit with you about any questions you might have in greater detail. The budget for medical education is $16,976,000, so right at $17 million. An 8% reduction is $1.35 million. UW's proposed budget reductions included reductions to the nurse practitioner program, the Pine Bluffs Clinic, and the Y-Dent, which is our dental program. The governor's recommendation, the governor did not recommend all 8% reduction. The governor recommended a reduction of $507,000 or 3%. The governor did not recommend closure of the Pine Bluffs Clinic. The governor did not recommend decreasing Y-Dent participation. He did concur with us in eliminating the loan repayment program for the psychiatric nurse practitioner program. I would remind you that there is no one in that program.
This is really a continuation of the presentation they gave this summer on that. Is there any further questions on this budget? All right. Representative Stewart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Real quick, again, we see the governor denied requests for compensation increases. Will these employees benefit from the $8.5 million similar to the other UW employees?
Madam Chairman, yes. They'd be treated the same way as the 067 budget.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I think I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about both of the Casper and Cheyenne facilities. I mean, I'd hate for you to leave without giving us an update on those centers.
Madam Chairman, both programs are up and functioning well. We have submitted to the governor on October 19th a plan, which I believe members of the JAC have received as well, with our proposed course of action to attempt to better deal with the increasing cost of the two residency programs. We have not yet heard back from the governor, but we'll move forward with the implementation of those recommendations, hopefully in the near term.
Good. Okay. Thank you. Any further questions of President Buchanan? Mr. Jones?
Madam Chairman, I, with respect to this budget, I wanted to point out a budget division error on page 16, if I could get you to turn there, please.
Okay.
On the bottom of page 15, you will note that the governor restored funding associated with the proposed elimination of the Pine Bluffs Clinic. That proposed elimination would also have reduced the positions, two full-time and one part-time positions. And if you go back to the top of page 16, you'll note that the restoration is not reflected in column 6.
Mm-hmm.
And so in column 3, you'll note the elimination of those positions, and in column 6, it should reflect the restoration of those positions in terms of the governor's recommendation.
Okay. Good. Thank you, Brett. Anything else on this budget? 167. All right. Thank you, President Buchanan.
Madam Chair, thank you very much.
Sure. Thank you, Chris. Now we have enhanced oil recovery. Agency 70.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman. I'm going to have to use my memory as far as budgets go. We're moving to the new Energy Innovation Center, and our accountant has been sick this week. So what I recall is our original budget was $2.83 million divided into two tasks, the larger of which supports EORI, the second of which is a smaller amount to support our commission. The 8% cut related to that amount would have been was $226,000. The governor recommended not reducing our budget.
Right. So I think just to make sure, David, we go back, go to page 18. Proposed reduction was the $33,793, and he denied that reduction, so reinstated, so that your revised appropriation is the $449,540.
Yes.
Okay. And then also on page 22, in Division 200 on the technical outreach and research, the same thing, he reinstated the $200,400.
Yes.
Correct? Okay. Is there any update you would like to give the committee before you're finished?
What I would add is that we've implemented a workshop program. We've had a number of major oil companies and small companies join our workshop sessions. As we presented last summer, we're focused primarily on the two largest opportunities to recover stranded oil in Wyoming, and those exist in the Menalusa reservoirs in the Powder River Basin and the Ten Sleep reservoirs in the Bighorn Basin. There's a lot of other opportunities, too. It's just that most of the 2 billion-plus barrels that the state's produced have come from those two reservoirs, and we've only recovered about 30% of the oil that's present in those reservoirs. We had two Ten Sleep workshops in Cody. We had Marathon participate, which is one of the largest, I think they are the largest oil producer in the state. And we had J.J. Bunkert participate, and they have one employee, and I think they make about 12 barrels a day. So quite a range of people. And we had 15 participants from the industry. We had a workshop on fundamental water flooding and reservoir engineering. We had a workshop on general enhanced oil recovery. We'll have a third workshop with the same group on characterization of residual oil zones, which are a huge opportunity in Wyoming, and implementation of CO2 EOR. And the news with CO2 is the state currently produces about 340 million cubic feet a day out of the Shoe Creek plant. That should triple in the next 3 to 5 years. Which would tell me that the oil production from CO2 enhanced oil recovery should triple. So that's good news.
Madam Chair, are you using all that from Shoot Creek then? Is all that CO2 pretty much bought up? A lot of it going to Salt Creek, or where is it?
Well, it goes several places.
Yeah.
And so the $240 million in the original expansion was used right away. The incremental 100 that Exxon's recovering, they've had some struggles getting it delivered, and it's because of they need operation-ready projects. So I think once Grieve comes online sometime in the next month, that'll take another $50 million a day.
Wow.
And I think it'll all be utilized. Yes. So because they have the capacity doesn't mean they're using it all the time. But
right.
we do have the capability. And we're seeing really rapid growth. As long as oil prices stay where they are, I expect to see growth actually increase. So the rate of growth will increase as more CO2 becomes available. It's also interesting to note that Shoe Creek has always provided carbon dioxide to Rangeley, which is in Colorado. And the new GreenCorp pipeline will provide CO2 all the way into Montana. But it's also going to provide it all the way through the Powder River Basin. Denbury, who owns and operates that line, just acquired Hartsock Draw when they sold their assets to Exxon, or one of Exxon, EOG, in the Bakken. They acquired Hartsock Draw in the Powder River Basin. They're forecasting 40 million barrels of incremental oil from Hartsock Draw, which is a Shannon formation. It's the second largest reservoir beyond the Second Wall Creek at Salt Creek. So things are happening, and it's good.
It's yeah. really nice to have news like this at 4:10 in the afternoon. I appreciate you having sat here all afternoon. No, this is good. All right. Yeah, that would
Madam
be
Chairman?
Great.
I just want to clarify, I'm not familiar with Hartsock Draw. Is that Montana and Wyoming? Or just
it's actually just in Wyoming.
That's okay. We don't want to share with Governor Schweitzer. Okay.
Yeah, smack dab middle
well,
in the Powder.
Good.
It's a big field.
Great. Thank you, David. I really appreciate it.
Thanks
Thank you for
having
your patience.
Me.
Yeah, we appreciate your good work.
Okay.
All right. Good. Mr. AG, are you ready? Good. Number 15. We'll just take a minute to get ready here.
Oh, no, yeah.
What? Oh, what do you get to run the show, Pete? Greg, do you want to introduce your team or have them introduce themselves?
Will
Whatever
do so.
You'd like to do.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Well, there was a team of two, but he has a group. They've been waiting all afternoon, so that'd be good just to introduce our new committee members so they know who all of you are. And then go ahead with any introductory remarks you have and proceed.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman, Mr. Chairman, members of the Joint Appropriations Committee. For the record, my name is Greg Phillips. I'm our state's Attorney General. Seated to my right is Pete Michael, someone you've met previous occasions, who is the Chief Deputy in my office. And behind me in the audience chairs are the various directors of the divisions within the Attorney General's office. Many people think of the Attorney General's office as a bunch of lawyers, but in fact, we're much broader than that. And so as I introduce each of the directors, I'd appreciate it if they could stand up just to reacquaint themselves with the committee. First, I'll name Steve Woodson, the director of the Division of Criminal Investigation. And Director Woodson has been with us for a few months now, but is a relatively recent appointment. His history is working with DCI, I believe, 6 years, and then went to work for the Drug Enforcement Agency in the federal government for, I think, about 20, and I should know that, Woody, and I don't know the exact number, but very well thought of. In addition to him, he has his chief deputy for operations, Kevin Haller, who has also appeared before this committee a number of times. Director Dave Harris from the Wyoming Law Enforcement Academy is here. Director Kara Chambers from the Division of Victim Services. We have Shannon Buller from the Governor's Council on Developmental Disabilities, who, because at the time her budget was not controversial and really unaffected, we did not invite her to the Judiciary Committee meeting on the budget, and then they had us go get her and ask her questions all about her agency for quite a while. So we took the precaution of bringing her here today. Jeff Scholes, who is the director of the Post Division, Peace Officer Standards and Training, is not here today. His budget is unaffected, and so we didn't believe that he would need to be here today. With that, Madam Chairman, are you ready for me to take into the budget? All right.
No, she's not. Not at all.
I did the same thing to her last meeting, and she is the one person who, if she left, my hands would start shaking. So, Laura Gorney. It's now a tradition. Madam Chairman, our budget is certainly not as complicated, perhaps, as others that you have been dealing with. In fact, it's only 71 pages, I believe, and perhaps the best way to approach it would be the same way that I did last time, which is simply to run through the budget bill with you. All right. I'll begin by saying that the two charts are very helpful. First of all, the big picture on page 4, which is the supplemental budget request summary table. And then on pages 8 and 9, we have the supplemental budget narrative. And between those two documents, much of what is included in our budget is visible and very transparent. We'll go to the more specific pages, however, and run the committee through each of what has been recommended by the governor with our budget for this committee. Let me begin on page 11, which is the law office, the attorney's part of the Attorney General's office. And the next page on page 12 shows the reductions that we recommended to the governor to meet our 8% requirement, and beginning with the Special Prosecution Fund, which is $175,000. The idea of that fund is that it's money set aside for counties who have high-cost prosecutions, death penalty or otherwise. And we feel we're able to make that reduction because the history of this particular fund, it has not been heavily drawn upon. And in any event, we are putting whatever burden would go with that high-cost prosecution back with the local governments by that recommendation. In addition, we are recommending reductions to dues, licenses, registration fees, and contracted services. The first part of that is largely CLEs, continuing legal education, that we send attorneys to. Since Pete and I have been here, and probably before, there has been a big effort to bring the CLEs back in-house and to do that as cheaply as we can to reduce the travel that's associated with that. And even to do CLEs from our own people to the rest of our people, the State Bar has been very cooperative with that. As far as the contracted services, the reduction could affect our ability to hire outside counsel when needed. That was a subject that came up in the last time that we appeared before this committee. And as I told the committee then, there is a real emphasis in our office to do everything we can in-house. And Mr. Mike will speak in a minute about two water positions and a support staff within the water division, and that is the best example I can give you of how that is done. There is litigation in the United States Supreme Court, Montana versus Wyoming, which Mr. Michael actually argued that case about a year ago or two. Is it a year or two, Pete?
Right in between. One and a half.
The contrast there is really remarkable in terms of how the two states are handling the litigation. Montana has hired that out to outside counsel. I suspect that the total bill on that would be somewhat staggering. Wyoming, on the other hand, has kept that all in-house. Mr. Michael, for a long time, led that charge. Now that he's chief deputy, we have broadened the number of attorneys involved working on it. We have 4 or 5 attorneys who we have brought into that and no outside counsel. So I know that's important to the committee, and it's also important to me as head of the Attorney General's office to do it that way. Then you see Also, that we are recommending two positions be taken out, two attorney positions be reduced out of our office, and it's the only way that we could begin to make 8%. So, in the governor's recommendation, the governor went along with that, of course, and recommended $228,189, which accounts for those two attorneys, and there's only $4,800 that is left, and we applied that to our 900 series. The next item on the bottom of page 12, it concerns water positions. When we took our budget to the Joint Judiciary Committee, Representative Throne continued an argument that was made during the last legislative session. And during the last legislative session, the full legislature took our recommendation, disconnected those water positions from the Water Development Fund, and instead funded them with general fund money. And at the same time, we labeled that as honesty in terms of what we're doing. We have various water funds, and we were using attorneys for those positions. At this point, I'll just ask Mr. Michael if he could briefly summarize that for the committee so that you know, first of all, why we would like to keep it the same, and second of all, what's involved in the situation.
Madam Chairman, I think I can do this briefly. Thinking back several to the last budget session, we had some accounts, as General Phillips said, specialized accounts for different litigation, North Platte and Bighorn being the two. The North Platte case had been settled in 2001, so actually what had happened over time from about 2001 through about when I came on to the Attorney General's office in 2006, we had some of those funds started being used to, they were being paying for water attorneys, but they were doing less and less work on those particular subjects. And by the time this came up several years ago, we had an attorney, for example, working on North Platte issues maybe 10% of the time, but being paid for out of the North Platte budget item. So when we found out as we went into the last budget cycle, or going into this biennium, 13-14, that fund was going to be insufficient to pay the two attorneys and the administrative assistant that were paid for out of that account. So something had to give one way or the other. It had, for those attorneys to stay, and they were necessary for the operation of the office, we had to find a source of funding. So the question was, should it remain coming from an account that really wasn't applicable to the work they were doing, or should it be general funded? And we felt for a number of reasons and recommended to the legislature, and it was adopted, that funding be done from the general fund. And what it amounts to then is that we have three attorneys in Wyoming that are full-time water quantity attorneys, a supervisor and two line attorneys, and one staff member, and they're now paid out of the general fund. And that really is accurate in the sense that one of them does a little bit of work for the Water Development Commission, but they really work for the state engineer, the Board of Control, and do a lot of work on interstate streams matters, including the litigation that General Phillips talked about, currently the Yellowstone River case, but we seem to repetitively have cases with other states, one after another. And we thought it was important. I know Senator Nicholas made this comment at the time, how important it was to maintain, I think his words were, a stable of attorneys, and we have a stable of three that are available to fight those fights, and they're learning as they go along, as they're specialists in water law. And to keep them, those attorneys know that their funding is out of the general fund and they have permanent positions. And, in fact, the funding would have gone away for those positions or been insufficient if that change hadn't been made. So we still believe that that's the better way to do it and the way it's being done now. In other words, we're asking for the status quo on that item and think it's the best way to run a railroad and the way we're running the railroad with water law.
Madam Chair, this actually might be for the governor's office. I just want to understand on the bottom of 12 the governor's recommendation, because if I understand, those two positions are empty at the moment or vacant.
Madam Chairman, the two positions that I just discussed are full.
Okay. No, the one above it, the elimination of two positions, are we talking about the same people here?
No, we're not.
Okay. That's where my question goes, because it talks about eliminating the positions not till next July 1. So is that allowing an opportunity to fill two vacant positions by then? And then it gives a term of how long they'll be vacant. I just want to understand that verbiage.
Brett?
Madam Chair, Senator Von Flatern, as I understand your question, you kind of have two questions. One is, can they be filled between now and July 1st of 2013? A concern about how we've approached that particular issue when we've identified a position for future elimination. The answer to that question is, we have provided a list of all identified or all proposed position eliminations to the Human Resources Division in ANI and have indicated to them that those positions should be frozen and can't be solicited for or filled as a result of their being proposed to be eliminated in the budget. So we're coordinating that with HRD, Human Resources Division, and ANI. And I'm sorry, the second piece of that question?
Well, it seems if these are empty, and why would there seems to be an effective date in July 1st of 2013, so then you wonder about filling them between now and that date, and then suddenly they're no longer there. And then that there's a time limit on how long they can be filled or how long they will be eliminated, 14 for a period of 15 months and position 161 for a period of 12 months. Is that what the intent is there?
Madam Chair, Senator Von Flatern, for the most part, when you look at positions that are proposed for elimination, you will see them, that proposal reflecting either a 12-month period or a 24-month period. So you do see some positions proposed for elimination for the entire biennium as a means of reaching their 8% reduction target for just the single fiscal year. In very few instances, you'll see more of this in the Department of Family Services, and this is one area where you'll also see it, is you see a proposed period for 15 months. The idea in terms of eliminating the position at that particular point in time is for the agency to receive the appropriate amount of dollar credit towards that 8% reduction. Does that make sense?
Not really, but I think I know what you're after, but why? I guess then why the difference in these two positions of 12 months and 15?
Madam Chair, Senator Von Flatern, it's really a product of them generating a sufficient amount of dollars to meet their 8% reduction target. So one has been identified for 15 and one has been identified for 12.
Senator Perkin.
Thank you. Madam Chairman, the question I have goes back up to the on the elimination of the special prosecution fund. I remember why we did that, and I know that it hasn't been used. Those cases came about, you know, we saw those, a couple of those, particularly the Matthew Shepard case comes to case. Anyway, two questions for you. One is I mean, ultimately this 175, it was unlikely to be spent. So when we give it up as an 8% reduction, you know, if it wasn't used, it would have reverted anyway. So but I want to clarify that you did count that in your 8% reduction. The other question I have for you, have you checked with, you know, I think this came at the request of a group of groups of county commissioners and sheriffs and others who have their budgets so adversely impacted when cases like that occur, and I just wondered if you'd had any feedback or solicited any comment from sheriffs or county commissioners when you made the determination to eliminate that.
Go ahead, Craig.
Madam Chairman, Senator Perkins, certainly when that item was identified as one to reduce to make the 8% that we were required to make, that was news in local government circles. And I had discussions with various county prosecutors about that, but I don't recall specifically talking to sheriffs or county commissioners as a group, certainly.
Okay. Representative Wallace.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is about the rationale for not using the water accounts for the lawyers that are dedicated to kind of those water-related issues. And I just want to make sure that I've got it clear in my head what your reasoning is for recommending that it be from general fund instead of the water accounts. So if you could expand on that a little bit. I think I heard you say that it was because they wouldn't be funded it wouldn't be a stable source of funding if it was coming from the water accounts, and I was questioning why that would be.
Well, Madam Chairman, in terms of stability, whether that those appropriations would be maybe I misstated myself. The point was that the appropriation that would cover those two positions, that particular appropriation was going to run out of money before the end of the biennium. So that appropriation could not be used and still maintain these employees. Sometime during the second year of the biennium, the money would disappear. There'd be no money to pay them. So whether that could be reappropriated, but if it was given the name, for example, the North Platte River Fund, well, that's not what these attorneys would be working for, the North Platte River Fund. So the legislature would have to come up with an idea that we're going to fund these positions with water development funds, but just do it in a general sense. So that was maybe the confusion I generated.
So thank you. That really helps me a lot. So if we could choose as a legislature to fund these things from the water accounts, but we would just have to make it a more general fund that would go carry on through time if we decided to do that.
Yeah, I think, Mr. Michaels, what they were trying to do is to make this transparent that this has multi-purposes or uses for these attorneys, and it's not specifically just the water development fund.
That's correct, Madam Chairman. And there's another element to it very quickly, is that the water attorney job really fluctuates. Right now we have attorneys in Sheridan that are going to be at depositions tomorrow in the Yellowstone case, and they're working double duty to represent the state in a lawsuit as well as do their regular jobs representing state engineer and the Board of Control and so forth. And then at other times, if a case like that goes away, you'll have some downtime, potentially, where an attorney may not have his plate completely full. And under those circumstances, if these attorneys are not dedicated to using funds from a water account but are funded from the general fund, we may take one of those attorneys, especially if they're a younger attorney, and move them into another part of the office for a short time, maybe on assignment to do criminal work or whatever, things that will develop their career, give them some trial experience, whatever. And we feel like for transparency purposes, having them funded from general fund, then there's no problem doing that. We're not doing something that's verboten budgetarily.
And then the third component is building the expertise within the AG's office to litigate water issues.
Exactly.
Good. All right. Any other questions? Representative Stewart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you have available to you the balance of what's in the North Platte litigation account, or is that held in Water Development Office?
The last I, Madam Chairman, the last I had, this is dated May of 2011 from that account. That had the particular account, the North Platte account that had the two attorneys and the paralegal, was approximately $550,000. Now, that date was another year before the, if I'm calculating correctly, that's well before the end of that biennium. So that would have been down to, I don't know what the number, but it would have been down to 200 some thousand by the beginning of this biennium. So that even if that money was B11 to the next budget biennium, it would not have been enough.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. I think we're ready to move on.
All right. Madam Chairman, on page, I'd refer the committee to pages 7 and 13. Pages 7 sets out the supplemental budget requests, and there are only three of them. The first is correction of standard budget revenue source, and you see the fund $614,971. On page 13, we see that very item addressed, and what happened here is just a mistake. In budget fiscal year 2011, the exception budget request was funded out of the tobacco trust fund in that amount, $614,000. The standard budget for budget fiscal year 2013 appropriately reduced department spending authority by that amount. The mistake was it reduced general fund appropriations, not the tobacco trust fund. And so all that this section does is to get that back in order the way it should have been. And you see the governor's recommendation there at the bottom of the page, near the bottom of the page, is to do just exactly that, and states that it was inadvertently removed, which is the way that it was. The Next item, Madam Chairman, is the Governor's recommendation as far as the addition of two full-time positions, including additional spending authority. And what's involved here, you see Department of Health. Department of Health for years had contracted out work on estate and third-party liability recovery activities for Medicaid divisions. And so a lump sum was paid to attorneys outside of our office to handle that. And Director Forslund saw that situation, thought that he could do that much more cheaply within our office and also have the expertise that is always available to him to do that work. And so he was the one who thought to bring them back into our office. Accordingly, and this has been done, accordingly, he gave two positions out of the Department of Health that were not filled, and they're still Department of Health positions for the reason that you stated there, or that is stated here in this paragraph, and that is they remain in the Department of Health so that we collect the 50% Medicaid match. But we have two lawyers now inside of our office rather than two lawyers outside of our office. That's what that's about.
Good. Okay. Seems like a wise move.
Yes, I think there's a cost savings for sure. On page 14, we see something that we see throughout the budget, which is IT positions are transferred to ETS. In this instance, there are two men who worked in our office for a long time who have been transferred over to that. On page 15, we see in the middle column there the figure $22,032, and this too will run throughout the budget. What this is about is the gold and silver plan for computer support system, where that's being taken out of the agency budget. You're well familiar. I see you nodding. So that's what that is about, Madam Chairman. The next item is on page 17, and it concerns Unit 102 of the Law Office Division. That is the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, and here again, we're talking about the Gold and Silver Plan. Otherwise, things remain the same. On page 19, we get to the school funding equity litigation in Unit 115 of the Law Office. And again, there we see the gold silver support plan coming back into ETS. On page 21, Madam Chairman, begins the division number 300, which is the Criminal Investigation Division. And there is a summary table provided there. On the next page, 22, we see in Section 2 the original plan for how we were going to make our 8% as an agency. And originally the plan was that basically to do it with people. And as you see in that first paragraph, what was proposed was to eliminate seven task force officers. They are officers who work for the local government, but the state pays up to $42,000 a year to work with DCI, and there are a lot of benefits to doing that, cross-training and so forth. There are 31 total positions to meet what I was requiring of DCI. They were eliminating seven of these positions. The next paragraph, consequences, the consequence was that there would be less availability of law enforcement support and investigative ability on those cases assigned to DCI with primary jurisdiction, that is drug crimes, computer crimes, internet crimes against children, as well as all of those cases DCI helps local law enforcement investigate, whether white-collar crimes, homicides, and oftentimes officer-involved shooting investigations as well. What happened, as you see on page 23, after Director Woodson took over, he met with Flint Waters and came up with a different plan where those positions would not have to be eliminated. And after I saw it, I endorsed it wholeheartedly, as did the governor, as we will see in the middle of the page 23. The idea there is to reduce a number of other items, in-state travel, out-of-state travel, and repair maintenance supplies. When we get to the CJIS portion of DCI, which is the Criminal Justice Information Services, you will see that there is a large figure dropped there, I think $700,000, which is accounted for by eliminating computer programs, so forth, that are acquired that provide enhancements in addition to the other computer system requirements. And when we get there, I'll be able to explain that a little better. In any event, as you see in the middle of the page, the governor recommended the modified proposed budget for DCI. Section 3, Madam Chairman, concerns the second item on page 7, concerns the Riverton Field Office. And the idea there, as you can see in the summary, is that DCI had long had a field office in Riverton, 15 years, that at least from the city of Riverton, but as the city's needs grew, there was less room for DCI, and finally they said, you need to find somewhere else. And so that's exactly what's happening here, is new space has been built by which DCI will have the ability to house its officers as well as a couple of federal officers as we continue to work together with federal law enforcement partners and relocate to that. What the governor recommended was to give half of the amount that we had proposed, that we reduce general fund by the full $52,600 if the modified plan were approved by this committee. And the governor reduced it only $26,300. So he cut that reduction in half, and yet we still made our 6.5% easily. Or on the nose, I should say, without any additional positions being lost. On page 27, Madam Chairman, we come to the crime lab, which is Unit 302 of DCI, and there are only certain ways to reduce within the crime lab, and you see them here, $30,500 to reduce lab supplies, and then in addition to that, I believe $30,500 as far as audit costs, proficiency, competency testing. And in that regard, at the bottom of the page, the governor agreed with those recommendations as well. And so as every agency comes in and says it hurts, these cuts hurt, that's one area where it hurt, but we fully recognize that we need to make the cut, and we did so. On page 30 of our budget, our proposed budget, Madam Chairman, you see the CJIS that I was talking about earlier. The original plan had been to reduce them by $100,000 in their 900 series budget, but as you see, the modified 8% reduction plan at the bottom of the page reduced the maintenance agreements by $720,000, and that's what enabled us to be able to keep the 7 task force officers while at the same time meeting the 8% at that time. And specifically, and that we have people who can answer these questions better, but the idea is that we have support and maintenance costs for Analysts International Corporation for the continued development of a couple of things, YCRIS, which is Wyoming Criminal History Records Information System, and then YCGIS, Wyoming Criminal Justice Information System. Those are reduced to user support and maintenance mode only with no enhancements. Now, what does that mean, no enhancements? And the answer is that as the law changes, for instance, the lottery bill, if the lottery bill were to pass and all of the backgrounds were required that are associated with that, and fingerprints and criminal history and so forth, that would certainly put an additional burden on DCI and CGIS, but it also may require enhancements within this area. And so we're kind of banking on not having a whole bunch more work in that area. To the extent that there is more work, then presumably we would have to absorb that across the various divisions within our office. But it's a good illustration of how an individual bill can affect the agency. On page 31, that is another instance in which IT positions are being moved to ETS. In this instance, there are 4 of those positions from DCI to ETS. Page 32, we have more of the gold and silver reassignment of that responsibility DTS, there are $60,996.
So, Mr. Phillips, we know that Mr. Waters has great familiarity with DCI, and certainly with all of this transition of the technology, are you seeing this to be a smooth transition and that you're able to keep the efficacy of the programs that you've got going currently in DCI?
Madam Chairman, generally I can speak to the two IT people that we lost from the law office and know exactly all that they did for us, and that has been a smooth transition to date. And I think there was a lot of wariness about that from both of those people, as you might imagine, as well as across state government, and I can report back to you that they have been put into areas that they were interested in, which they can specialize, and they're both happy with the move, and our services continued to be good.
Be reliable.
Yes, and on the DCI IT people, those four people, my understanding is the same, is that has worked out well for everyone concerned.
Getting lots of positive nods in the back, so it looks like it's working out okay. Great. Okay, good. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. The next page, page 34, the Meth Initiative, which is Unit 304 within DCI. There, what that's made of, most people don't know, is when this was created, two people already within DCI, one agent and one lab person, who, as I say, were working there at the time, were simply assigned over by name to the Meth Initiative. And so nothing there except to reduce the repair and maintenance supplies by $20,000. And what that, as you see, can be achieved through reduced law enforcement supply purchases, such as ammunition, and by decreasing training from quarterly to semi-annually. So we believe that we can make that cut and still continue the service.
Go ahead.
Madam Chairman, two things on that. First of all, just interested, at least the last I had heard that actually methamphetamines dropped down now to probably the second or third drug of choice with respect to that. And I'm just wondering on the meth initiative, which is, due to a lot of factors, part enforcement, part education, part lots of reasons. But anyway, first of all, is there any plans to change the meth initiative? That's the first question. I've got another one after that.
Right. Madam Chairman and Senator Perkins, as I understand it, over the years it has been suggested several times that the meth initiative be absorbed back into DCI and lose that distinction of that title. And in speaking with the DCI director and deputy before we came upstairs, I asked that very question, where does that stand? And I think both of them would be favorable toward that. Now, as far as how methamphetamine stands in relation to the other illegal drugs in the state, I can give you this information from personal knowledge, and then I'll turn it over to the director, who knows far, far more. And that is, when I was at the U.S. Attorney's Office, we saw, as a result of a lot of prosecutions up in Gillette and otherwise across the state, that the flow of methamphetamine was impeded enough that the price went up by a fairly significant amount, and that itself reduced some of the amount that was being used within the state. But Senator Perkins, I think Director Woodson, that's what he's done really his whole life, mostly in Wyoming, but for a short stint in New Mexico, and so he could speak to that very authoritatively.
Does he have a microphone? Okay. Welcome, Madam, Director Woodson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Senator Perkins. I would say that methamphetamine is still an extremely significant problem in Wyoming, and I would say that it's a very high percentages of the cases that we deal with still today, and have been since I've been in Wyoming, to be honest with you. It caught a lot of attention at one time. That attention maybe has waned a little bit, but I don't think the drug has necessarily waned in our communities. In my experience, we're still seeing a large flow of methamphetamine coming into Wyoming from internationally and elsewhere in the United States.
Follow up.
So, and I guess that brings us back to the when you go there. And the real question is: do you do you see the meth initiative as needing to continue or to just fold it back into the other programs and allow you to prioritize among your own agency, or what are your feelings about that?
My feelings were echoed by the Mr. Attorney General, that I believe it could be handled by just rolling it back into the DCI budget. We don't need, in my opinion, a separate initiative to handle that.
And if I can follow up one more, and just, I mean, this was a number of other places, but when you went back and looked at the ammunition purchases, how much of that, I mean, as I read that, it looked to me like that was that basically what we're doing there in that budget cut is we're simply going back, and for the most part, you're going back to the local agencies, whether it be sheriff's departments or...
On that, I would, you know, I just... Are you saying, so what you were saying at the beginning of this, that the decision was made to cut it out of that just to satisfy...